listening to Football in Europe, the weekly podcast covering the game across the continent.
It's the new Football in Europe podcast, episode 15, with your latest news, talking points and strange stories from Germany, Spain, Italy, France and more. I'm Rob Daly. Chris Parrott is my co-host. Chris, what are we discussing this week?
Well, Valencia have sacked their manager, so Phil Neville looks set for a spell in caretaker charge there. Juve, the old lady of Italian football, have finally woken up. Bayern win again, and a goalkeeper scores in Greece.
Guardian football journalist Jonathan Wilson joins us to discuss Eastern European football, while ESPN FC and beIN Sports' Jonathan Johnson joins us from Paris as Paris Saint-Germain return to the French capital.
This is Football in Europe.
Chris, happy birthday.
Thank you very much.
It was your birthday on Sunday.
30.
30 years old.
My Lord. It was actually the first time, you know, everyone says, oh, does it feel different being a year older, that sort of. I actually watched the clock tick over, having driven back from Manchester, from 23:59 to 0:00. 0:00 and a sad moment.
Were you a bit sad?
20's gone.
Well, yeah. 20's long gone, mate.
Ten years ago, actually.
You stayed at the Hotel Football in Manchester, didn't you?
Yeah.
You were covering United, their youth team.
Yeah, I really enjoyed it, the hotel, actually.
What's going on in there?
Well, it's just like a perfect football fan's treat.
This is the Gary Neville. Who else is involved in this hotel?
Just the whole class of 92,
I think.
Yeah, they've got... there's a five-a-side pitch on the roof. There was one notable thing, actually, on the menu. They've got, like, you know, they've... They're very clever. They, you know, be like, oh, order Giggs's burger or something like that. One of them.
Giggs doesn't eat burgers. He does yoga.
And one of them was Phil Neville's, who we're going to speak about in a bit. So they'd all chosen like ribs, burgers, something like that. He chose a risotto.
Phil Neville. There's a Phil Neville risotto.
Phil Neville risotto, and it's something like, oh, I've chosen the healthy option or something like that. Phil, have a burger.
Have a paella.
Have a paella. Ooh,
this is
nice.
The way this is going. We'll talk about Phil Neville potentially being Valencia manager for a bit later in the show. Last week, we asked you for your favourite European football stadiums, and people really like this because we had a lot of people in touch. Mohamed says, the Velodrome, it's so chaotic to the point where an effigy was made of Valbuena for his return. That was quite a bad thing that happened. Plus, choreography is top-notch. Jonathan Stephen goes for the Sucru Saracoglu in Istanbul. Turkish clubs have the intense, intimidating atmospheres like young fans miss out on in the UK. Kurt Hurd has sent us a really good one. He's currently travelling around Europe, Chris. This sounds like your dream holiday, right?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
He's travelling around Europe watching football as we speak. And he's been to Bohemians Prague, and he sent us the... pictures of the stadium. We have retweeted this because you were just in Prague.
Yeah, absolutely. There's so many football grounds, including another one we got in from Liam Ross as well, who watched a youth game in their former national stadium, which is on top of the hill in Prague. And I think it holds the record for the biggest ever attendance. But now it's used as a training ground. It's like an enormous bowl. So there's room for about 10 pitches in it. But I was speaking to someone from the FA in the summer, actually at the under-21s, and their long-term plans are to renew that famous old stadium.
Oh, okay, right.
And to make it huge. They've just opened Eden Stadium not that long ago, but that one is amazing because it's just so big inside.
I wonder if those two are hanging out. That'd be weird if they weren't together, but have both tweeted us in from Prague.
Yeah. Oh, well, maybe everyone's just listening to the Football Europe podcast.
It's
because
so.
I waved an enormous banner last week when I was there.
I've checked the listening figures. Not everyone is listening. Alexandru Machea, by the way, has gone for the home of Rapid Bucharest. He says instead of reading out a reason or giving you a reason, put this on. And he sent us a YouTube link to the atmosphere there, which we'll retweet this week as well. And Chris, people are being very nice to us, leaving us reviews on iTunes because that helps us stay in the charts. But I just wonder sometimes if people's names and Twitter handles and stuff that can undermine a really nice review. Like, we had two great reviews, one from Mr. Peanut 23.
23, so Mr. Peanut 1 to 22 is taken.
And Evil Monkey. Evil Monkey left us such a great review, along with Connor Malloy next to the aisle and Stuart Overton, who's been a listener for some time. Please leave us reviews on iTunes. That helps us stay in the charts. Tweet us. FIE podcast if you have any questions for me and Chris, and you can follow our audio boom for exclusive content. Okay, let's hear from our first guest this week. It is the football journalist and commentator Jonathan Johnson, who works in Paris. writes for ESPN FC, works for beIN Sport as well. And we just wanted to get the latest from him on the situation with Paris Saint-Germain playing their first home game back at the Parc des Princes with the French national team with Valbuena and Benzema, and also the state of the title race in France.
This is Football in Europe.
Jonathan, thanks for joining us on the podcast.
Thanks a lot for having me on.
It was Paris Saint-Germain's first home game since the attacks in Paris. What was the scene at the Parc des Princes as they took on Troyes?
Yeah, it was very emotional. Security was very high. PSG are famous for having their players make an entrance on the red carpet. That's something that will become a thing of the past. I imagine probably for the entirety of this season now, certainly until France is out of its state of emergency. Very emotional, build up to the game. The French flag on the pitch before the match, emotions high among the Parc des Princes crowd. And then PSG dismantled Troyes, as normal service resumed after the tribute to the victims pre-match.
I remember reading, and there was lots of speculating reports about whether players would feel comfortable coming back to Paris, but that doesn't appear to have been a problem.
No, PSG have hired lots of extra security for the players. Anybody who feels uncomfortable and that they might be a threat, they've even been given security that they can take home and have watching their houses round the clock. So I think that PSG have pulled out all the stops to make sure all of their players are still comfortable in the city at the club. I know a lot was made about Edinson Cavani's comments, David Luiz's comments, and I think at the time, immediately in the aftermath of the attack, that was it was fair enough what they were saying. I think if you'd offered anybody who was in Paris at that time, the chance to escape the city for a few days, they would have bitten your arm off really and taken that offer. So I don't think it was really that much of a surprise that many of the players who were on international duty at the time acknowledged the fact that they would rather not go back to Paris, but they were obliged to because they're PSG players.
What has been the fans' reaction and the general reaction to the fact that away fans can't go to games in Ligue 1 at the moment? Has there been a level of understanding from football fans in France?
Yeah, there has. There's been a lot of frustration, obviously, because it's a big part of many people's routines, and that takes away a massive part of their weekend, the highlights of some people's week. So obviously there is frustration, but also understanding, considering the situation in Paris at the moment, or the situation in France in general at the moment. So I think that many fans are just hopeful that this is, just something temporary that they'll have to put up with for the next couple of weeks. And then it's something that will, eventually be weaned back in.
Were you at home the night of the attacks? Where were you, Jonathan?
No, I was actually at Stade de France that night.
Oh, wow. So what was it like inside the ground?
It was, I think there was a lot of confusion. It only really became clear during the second half of the game exactly what was going on, the scale of what was going on in Paris. And we only really learned after the match, exactly how close we were to, perhaps witnessing something a lot worse than what was seen at Stade de France. I think Saturday was probably, that was the most chilling moment, the Saturday after the game, when it was revealed that one of the suicide bombers actually had a ticket to get into the stadium and was turned away. You could imagine how much worse the total death count and what we saw at Stade de France would have been had he been able to get into the stadium. But at the time, on the Friday, it was a real challenge trying to keep up with the game, but also what was going on and what was developing in Paris, and trying to find out exactly what had gone on outside of Stade de France. There were so many things going on, helicopters buzzing around the stadium at various points in the second half, and then the fact that so many people in the stadium quite clearly didn't know exactly what was going on in Paris, and the fact that the players didn't know either, that sort of added to this this bizarre atmosphere that was created at Stade de France that night.
I was fascinated by the idea to let the game continue and to not cause alarm, which did seem to have a tremendously smart effect on the way that fans dispersed after the game and after the match. I mean, was there a little bit of reaction to the fact that fans were not kept in the dark about what was happening, but that things were carrying on as normal?
Yeah, I mean, I think what you've got to bear in mind is when you're at Stade de France or any big venue like that, when the crowd is near capacity, it's very difficult to get mobile phone signals. So it's unsurprising that so many people were in the dark about what was happening. But I think, you know, it was the right decision to allow the game to continue. Probably the right decision to not tell the players at that time, because had they known, I think many of them would have either asked to come off and not play, you know, or it would have been very obvious once both teams took to the pitch that, you know, their minds were elsewhere and that something was going on. And then I think more fans would have been asking questions. There was a period in the second half when that nobody was allowed to enter or exit the stadium while the blast area close to the stadium was cleared up, and you know, more details were passed on, and you know, the scene sort of was pieced together by many people. But I think it was the right decision to keep the fans in the stadium and keep the game going, because had that not happened, you know, I think we would have seen people, you know, cramming to try and get out of the stadium, you know, rushing to you know, the nearest exit close to them, and I'm sure that would have caused some injuries, if not some fatalities as well. So I think that it was the right decision to avoid any chaos by fully informing the public of exactly what was going on at the time, you know. And I think that the Stade de France security handled it very well as well after the match, just telling certain sections of the stadium that they weren't allowed to exit at that moment, that they would have to you know, wait in the stadium until further notice. But not explain exactly what had happened in the city and outside the stadium.
Jonathan, let's turn our attentions back to the actual football for a little bit as well. Last night, Monaco played out that 3-3 draw with Marseille. Is it disappointing that there isn't more of a title race on, because those two teams who should in theory be challenging are well off the pace of Paris Saint-Germain?
It is a bit disappointing that Monaco and Marseille are so far behind in terms of a title race, but at the same time, I thought, you know, the 3-3 draw was a fantastic advert for Ligue 1. I don't think the real disappointment lies with Monaco and Marseille in terms of a title challenge. I don't think many people expected Marseille to challenge, even if Marcelo Bielsa had stayed, you know, obviously left after the first game of the season. With Monaco, I think everybody knew before the season started it was going to be very difficult for them to launch a title challenge, because Leonardo Jardim has, you know, essentially seen half of his squad stripped away from him, and, you know, a new grill group has been built up. So he's only really just starting to stamp his authority on that squad now. But I think the real disappointment of the season have been Lyon, because, you know, Lyon had the players, they had the squad to be able to push PSG a bit closer than they have done so far this season. But Lyon have really struggled balancing European and domestic commitments. A few of their summer signings like Mapu-Yenga and Biwa, Raphael, you know, they've been quite disappointing since arriving at the club. And also Hubert Fournier is really struggling. He's going through this second season syndrome as coach, finding things a lot more difficult this time around. And I think that is in part down to the fact that they lost Nabil Fekir to long term injury. You know, for any club to lose a player of that calibre, you know, they would feel his absence. So it's no surprise that they're missing him a bit. But I do think that even with Fekir out, Lyon should be doing much better than they are at present. And the gap between them and PSG, which, you know, is currently at 16 points, should not be that big. You've got to bear in mind as well, PSG host Lyon in a couple of weeks, so the gap between those two teams could be greater come the winter break.
And also surrounding Lyon at the moment is this Valbuena Benzema alleged blackmail case, which just continues to rumble on. I know people are trying to avoid going into the specifics of it because the legal proceedings are still absolutely happening. But what's been the impact, you think, on the French national team, and what will be the impact on the French national team ahead of, you know, the European Championships?
Well, there's a lot of uncertainty at the moment. I mean, the immediate impact, certainly before the revelations of last week between Valbuena and Benzema, when Valbuena came out and said that, you know, his relationship with Benzema is not what he thought it was, casting, you know, a lot of doubt on, you know, the validity of Benzema's comments that he is, you know, innocent in all of this. You know, I think before that, the big question was whether this would all be cleared up in time for both of them to feature in the Euros. But I think now the big question is, what is Didier Deschamps going to do? Because it seems like, regardless of what happens, whether this all gets cleared up before the Euros or not, he is going to have to continue without one of those key players for the Euros. Because at this moment in time, I just don't see how, certainly Benzema can play for the French national team at the moment. You know, I think it's maybe a bit too soon to say, you know, is this the end of Benzema's international career? But depending on the outcome of all of this and what happens between him and Valbuena, then, you know, I definitely think that it might be a long time before we see Benzema back in blue for France. I think it's going to be a challenge now for Valbuena to get his mind back on football, but I think that he stands a better chance than Benzema of getting back into the team for the first set of friendlies in March of next year. Deschamps, you know, rates both very highly. They're both very important members of his plans for France ahead of the Euros, but I think you could arguably say that Valbuena is slightly more important than Benzema. Benzema, when he's on form, is absolutely indispensable for Deschamps and for France. But, you know, he's a very capricious character on the pitch, and he's not always the same player that we see week in, week out for Real Madrid for France. So I think that Valbuena is definitely the player that that Deschamps is going to be most keen to get back into the international setup at the beginning of next year.
Jonathan, it's been fascinating. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast this week. Really appreciated.
This is Football in Europe, La Liga Latest.
Okay, so we're going to hear from Guardian football writer Jonathan Wilson very shortly. Chris, let's look at matters in Spain. Valencia lost 1-0 to Sevilla in a meeting of two managers under pressure, and the losing manager has left Valencia, Nuno.
Yeah, he has resigned. Marca reporting actually that the owner, Peter Lim, tried to change his mind, but he'd had enough. Great win that for Sevilla, because although they've beaten Real Madrid and Barcelona, they're mid-table after that amazing year last year, and Unai Emery being linked with all sorts of jobs, including Real Madrid, AC Milan, hasn't quite gone according to plan. Some amazing stats. Dermot Corrigan, the ESPN journalist who's appeared on the show: Sevilla had 15 shots to Valencia's none, 17 corners to Valencia's none. That's a 1-0 hammering.
It certainly is. And Valencia have just not been any good this season. Nuno's been under a lot of pressure. I saw them play Zenit in the Champions League in the week, and they were, you know, offered very little indeed. But there's an interesting situation because Phil Neville's been assistant manager there. So what now for him?
Well, it looks like he's going to be the caretaker boss, which is amazing, really, isn't it? I mean, there aren't many English managers abroad, let alone Phil Neville in charge of, you know,
His old mate David Moyes has just left, hasn't
he? Well, exactly.
Yeah.
But, you know, Valencia are an enormous club, even to have a caretaker spell in charge of. They have a cup game in midweek, I guess. I mean, Nuno's
been... they're saying he's going to take charge of that.
Yeah, right? They are. And then at the weekend, if they haven't got anybody in, they face Barcelona. Neville against Luis Enrique.
Well, it's interesting because on Twitter as well, Gary Neville's been giving him loads of stick about his Spanish. So, I wonder about this, about whether he can... He'll need a translator, surely, to probably communicate ideas to his players.
Yeah, but it'll be fascinating. Is he going to do the press conferences beforehand? Is it, you know, all of those things that a caretaker would normally do? Is that going to be Phil Neville?
Well, he's got by so far somehow.
It's going to be a great watch.
Real Madrid got an unconvincing 2-0 win at Eibar, from what I read, and from what I saw as well, it was a rather dodgy penalty decision that gave Ronaldo his chance to make it 2-0 from the spot after Bale's opener. Florentino Perez last Monday, Chris, just after we recorded the podcast, gave Rafa Benitez the vote of confidence. But Perez himself, as we heard last week, is under a lot of pressure.
Yeah, he is. It's just the way at Real Madrid, isn't it? I think since that Champions League final, when they won La Decima, they were on top of the world. They'd been after that for so long. And you look now at the gap between them and Barcelona, and it's huge.
You're talking in terms of... because 6 points between the teams, but you're talking in terms of how they're playing.
How they're playing. I mean, you saw in El Clasico how much better Barcelona were than Real Madrid's. Barca, of course, won the Champions League themselves. And when you're Real Madrid's, you are expected to win everything. And when Barcelona are as good as they are, I think that makes Real Madrid look even worse.
So Florentino Perez is under pressure. They might have to call an election earlier than he would have liked because of legal proceedings going on at the moment about the conditions in which you can apply to be president of the club. It's all a little bit complicated, but it's whether Florentino Perez might have to have an election. Regardless, I do think his second spell has been a failure.
Oh, no.
Okay, so 2009 he took over as president again to now.
Yeah.
Here's the trophies he's won. So, yeah, he won the Champions League. Well, Real Madrid won the Champions League in 2014, and they won the Copa del Rey in the FIFA World Club Cup. I mean, you're getting La Liga in 2012 under Mourinho, and the Copa del Rey, that was also under Mourinho, wasn't it? 6 years, one league title.
Yeah, but...
One European title.
La Decima. It's clouded over Real Madrid ever since they won their ninth title.
No, I think Real Madrid, that trophy deludes people into thinking.
I'm not sure. He signed Cristiano Ronaldo, one of Real Madrid's greatest ever forwards.
He's won one league title there, Ronaldo.
He's won La Decima. Remember, he brought Jose Mourinho to Real Madrid as well, Perez. Yeah. They had been knocked out in the last 16. They couldn't get beyond it. It was a mental block. Mourinho didn't win it, but he reached three straight semi-finals, of which they lost a couple on penalties. And then under Ancelotti, he brought in Carlo Ancelotti. He delivered La Decima. And I don't think for that, if they hadn't won that, yes, it would be. But the fact they won that 10th European title, I don't think you can call his second spell a failure.
Mm, okay. Tweet us what you think, FIE podcast. Barcelona got a 4-0 win against Real Sociedad. Neymar, Messi and Suarez were scoring. Not very surprising there. Luis Enrique has said he is potentially looking at strengthening the team in January, that he's always for strengthening his team. Atletico beat Espanyol, but Thiago's out for 4 months with an injury, so a big blow for them. And in a battle of two relegation-threatened teams, Granada scored two in the final 7 minutes to earn a crucial draw at Malaga, and it finished 2-2. Very disappointing for them. Chris, Arith Adarith, the Athletic Bilbao striker.
Yeah, amazing. He scored two. They beat Rayo Vallecano 3-0. He's now got 20 for the season in all competitions.
He's 34 years old.
He is.
He's banging them in.
They're actually only 4 points behind Celta now, Athletic Bilbao, in the race for that last Champions League place. But the manager came out afterwards and said, I hope Barca don't try and sign him in January.
Well, it's interesting because I did the research for Belgium-Spain. I was going to commentate on that game before it was cancelled. And a lot of the talk in Spain was, you know, why isn't Del Bosque giving him a chance? And Del Bosque's attitude appears to be, he's too old, he's not for the future, so there's no point. But Diego Costa's not scoring for the national team. I mean, would you give him a... Is there any point giving someone a call up at that age, do you think?
Well, it's a difficult one. If he carried on scoring like this, he might have to reassess in, you know, when are the next international friendlies? March, I think.
Yeah.
But you can see why you'd stick with Diego Costa, I think. By the way, how good does Enrique want Barca to be? I mean, they've got Alex Vidal and Arda Turan coming in January anyway.
Where's Arda Turan going to fit in?
I have absolutely no idea. Right. But Barca are that good now, he could probably play left back and he'd fit in perfectly. They're just... The only thing is if they've peaked too soon.
We'll see. Barcelona top by 4 points in La Liga. Okay, let's now hear a part one of my chat with Guardian football writer Jonathan Wilson. He's also written numerous books, including Inverting the Pyramid, that iconic tactics book, and Behind the Curtain, his tales of visiting football through Eastern Europe. So here is part one of our chat. We'll give you part two of that next week.
For more, head to the website footballineurope.co.uk.
What I remember from reading Behind the Curtain, and one of the things that most struck me and has stayed with me about Eastern European football, is how the political state of a country has an impact on not just the management of clubs, but the functionality of the team and how they play. Have you seen a big change, you think, in the way that Eastern European football teams play?
Yeah, I mean, the first change, obviously, is the quality that... through the 70s and 80s, we became quite used to seeing very, very good, technically accomplished, tactically brilliant Eastern European sides. And the reason for that was it was very easy for the top clubs to keep players together. You weren't constantly running the risk of something being sold. There wasn't that same throughput of the players that we've become used to. And obviously state funding means that the normal economic pressures that clubs have were reduced. But since 1990, that state funding has disappeared. Players now move abroad very, very young. In Yugoslavia, I think, is the great example that there was a regulation there that you could leave when you're 28. And so a lot of them went to France. And I was talking to Philippe Auclair yesterday, and he was saying that he sort of remembered this process he went through as a kid, and I guess slightly older, sort of almost looking at the Yugoslav national side and thinking, oh, he's 26 in 2 years, maybe we can sign him. Whereas now, players leave the former Yugoslavia in their teens. It's a bit like the situation in South America, where if you're playing Eastern Europe and you're in your 20s, it probably means you're not a great player. that you're not going to make it. I mean, obviously, there's certain exceptions, likes of Shakhtar, likes of Zenit. But essentially, anybody with any talent leaves very young, and that obviously has a hugely detrimental effect.
Do you think, I mean, you mentioned it there, do you think you need to be a financial superpower to be an Eastern European team that can compete in European football?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's a logical thing that I think what Shakhtar have done may be slightly bucksishness, a very intelligent thing that they make their links in Brazil, that Brazilian players see that Shakhtar is a place with this Brazilian culture, that Brazilians have gone there and have succeeded and have enjoyed it and have got bigger moves or have stayed there and have done well. So I spoke to Douglas Costa when he first moved over there, and he was saying one of the reasons that he moved there was he ranked some of the players he played with at the Brazil under 20 squad who were already at Shakhtar, and they said, yeah, it's great, good, you know, really good training grounds, they pay your money on time, you know, the football's good, Luchescu's a good coach. So, I mean, that's the way you do it. But, I mean, if you're a kid growing up pretty much anywhere that's not Eastern Europe, then I guess your inclination is to go to one of the more glamorous football cultures, to Spain, to Italy, to England, to Germany. And the only way around that is to pay the extra money. And, of course, it's the same with stopping players leaving. There's just so much more credibility, so much more, I think glamour is the word, about the sort of big four, big five Western European leagues, that inevitably kids growing up in Russia and Ukraine, in Serbia, wherever, are looking at making a move pretty much as soon as they can.
We had Darren O'Dea on the show early in the season, and he'd been playing, I think it was a Metallurg Donetsk, when there were real problems in the city. Do you have any thoughts about Shakhtar not playing there at the moment? I think they're playing in Lviv, aren't they? And training in Kiev. I can't remember which round that is. But
yeah, that's right. Yeah, well, I mean, I guess it's an inevitable thing for them. They can't play in Donetsk. In the stadium, I'm not sure what state it's in, but I know there's some pictures came out, I think around about a year ago, showing that it suffered shelling. It's clearly impossible to play there. And yeah, irrespective of almost of what's the specifics of what's going on in the conflict, they would be a target. You know, they are the most. If you think of Donetsk, you say Donetsk for somebody in Western Europe, what do they know about Donetsk? They know Shakhtar, they don't really know anything else. So, you know, their status, of course, makes them a target, and therefore for safety, they obviously can't play there. And that clearly makes things very difficult. I mean, it makes it difficult for fans, it makes it difficult, I think, for players, because the training base in Donetsk that they have is sensational. I can't believe there's a better one in the world. You know, it's
was this the one with the aviary?
Yeah, I don't know if that's still there, but certainly it used to have an aviary. It had these ponds where you could go fishing that had swans on them. So in terms of the idea is, if you're a foreign player going there, you just live on the training base, and it's like an incredibly luxurious hotel. So you've got all the sort of entertainment, but you've also got absolute state-of-the-art medical centre and gyms and all the sort of football infrastructure as well. So not to be able to use that is clearly detrimental to them. Quite apart from just the logistical issues of training in one city and having to travel. I mean, I presume they fly, but about an hour's flight away in Lviv.
Andre Villas-Boas at Zenit has got them into the next round of the Champions League as group winners. They're not as good domestically, but what do you make to the Portuguese coach and the job he's doing there?
I think they're doing brilliantly, and I'm really glad for him. I thought we, as an in terms of English football culture, treated him pretty badly when he was here. I think he inherited a Chelsea squad that was all but unmanageable, and maybe his own personality didn't help. But I think it was a hugely difficult job that. And then Tottenham, although Pochettino has made great strides this season, this season and last season, and maybe is starting to change the culture at the club, Tottenham remains Tottenham. And all the flaws that we've historically seen at Tottenham, that idea that they're soft touch, that idea that they don't use the money that wisely, the idea there's always a couple of bad eggs in the squad. I think what Pochettino's done in terms of cleaning out a couple of the bad eggs and getting people like Vertonghen playing for him, where I think Vertonghen was quite difficult for a couple of previous managers. Getting rid of Baldini, so he's now the sole power at the club. Then that was something that AVB couldn't handle. But I think in pure football terms, I think he's a very, very interesting coach. I think it's very easy to underrate what he did with Porto. And it's good to see see that working again. And I think it's good to see Zenit doing well. I mean, I think they should have. They've underperformed in the last 3 or 4 years. And I think it's important that you have a club who doesn't come from England, France, Germany, Spain, or Italy that can challenge. And okay, maybe they probably won't win it, but maybe even get to a quarter final or semi final and remind people that there is life outside of Western Europe.
This is Football in Europe, Bundesliga Roundup.
And we'll have more from our chat with Jonathan Wilson on the show next week. Chris, Serie A chat on the way, but for now, Bundesliga. Bayern with a 2-0 win over Hertha Berlin. Hertha were actually fourth in the table going into the weekend, looking for the Champions League spots. Thomas Müller scoring 13 goals in 14 games. He's been unbelievable this season. But Pep Guardiola, I mean, his future was the main talking point before and after the game. So what's the latest on that?
And it will be the main discussion for the rest of the season. His contract is up in the summer. He hasn't said whether he's going to stay at Bayern, whether he's going to go anywhere. Of course, this three-year deal, having taken over from Jupp Heynckes. He's getting thoroughly annoyed, I think. He walked out of a press conference recently. He didn't do his pre-match press conference. I think he wants to speak about the football and how well Bayern are playing, because they are playing well, brilliantly, as we know. But he's been linked with everybody in Spain. He's been linked with Real Madrid, remarkably, in England.
Surely not.
But yeah, this morning, the papers are saying he'd rather go to Manchester United than Manchester City. This is the thing, isn't it? I think every football club would like Pep Guardiola as their boss. Well, certainly probably every owner would. I know Peter Schmeichel came out and said that he doesn't think Guardiola would be a good fit at United, for example. But that's the problem. And until Pep Guardiola decides himself what he's going to do, we're probably going to be chatting about this for the coming weeks.
Yeah, and Sir Alex Ferguson did speak to Guardiola, he revealed, about the job in the 2012-13 season. And he was at a fan event on Sunday, Pep Guardiola, saying he is loving life in Munich, and he loves working with Bayern, but he won't be drawn into a commitment one way or the other. So some of the tweets we've had in about this, people giving their opinion. Charlie says Guardiola should tell Bayern so that they aren't left without a manager at the end of the season. Other than that, it's his business. Stuart says if he is staying at Bayern, announce it as soon as possible. If he's leaving, it should be at the end of the season, as it could potentially disrupt the team. Chris, where do you stand on this? I mean, is this potentially harmful to Bayern?
Don't think so, no. And the proof in that is that they've basically won every game. They've got almost double the amount of points than fourth place Mönchengladbach in the Bundesliga already. They're flying in the Champions League. Okay, they lost in London against Arsenal, but then they hammered them and hammered Olympiakos. And for as long as it's not affecting the team, I don't see the problem. I think the issue will come to a head if they got knocked out of the Champions League.
Yeah, so we're talking later in the season.
Because then all of a sudden, and they might not get knocked out of the Champions League, let's be honest, the way they're playing, but say they lost in the semi-final, then Guardiola would be, if he left, he would be leaving without winning that competition. I think he'd see that as a failure. I think most people would see that as a failure.
Winning the Champions League.
Yeah, by Bayern's very high standards. So I think it only comes to a head if they get knocked out of that competition, because then suddenly it's like, well, does he stay to try and win it? Or does he leave without winning it? But for now, it's not impacting how Bayern are playing.
The club have said that they're going to speak to him during the Christmas break. And, you know, some people say we might know more by January. But I just wonder how long this will go on for. Let's turn our attention to some other games in Germany. In the Nord Derby, Hamburg won 3-1 at Werder Bremen. What a result for them. Remember that Hamburg, the week before, beat Borussia Dortmund at home. So they're in a good run of form. Dortmund, meanwhile, got a 4-1 win against Stuttgart. Two goals for Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang. And a response from Dortmund, because they lost in the Europa League as well to Krasnodar.
Yeah, exactly. And there's been criticism of Mats Hummels. And after that great start under Tuchel, I think they needed that. Not so good for the Stuttgart caretaker who is in charge, Alexander Zorniger, leaving the club, of course. So Jürgen Kramny, difficult first assignment, and they keep on scoring own goals, Stuttgart. I think it's their fourth or fifth this season. Amazing.
Oh, wow.
That. And I mean, you don't need to give Dortmund any help in front of goal, but they did. Comfortable win. But as you mentioned, yeah, important that for Dortmund. It's so hard playing second fiddle to Bayern, isn't it?
Yeah, it is, and that will be the case this season. But I mean, with Mats Hummels, you know, there are continued transfer rumours, and there will be about Mats Hummels, I think, until long after he retires. I think. what category of centre-back do you think he comes under? Because he's still linked to Manchester United. Are we talking about a Piqué, Ramos guy? I mean,
I think I'd put him just below. But could he do a job at Manchester United and at Liverpool and at Chelsea? Yeah, he could.
I think the same, because I think he is just slightly below that bracket. And that is being super harsh.
Yeah.
But I think positionally sometimes he does let himself down. But I think because he looks so composed.
Exactly. He's like that Rolls Royce. He goes through games and you're just like, wow, he looks so good. But as I said, would he be a good addition for any of the Premier League's big boys? He would. And not just him. I mean, I'm getting almost fed up of reading about Jurgen Klopp going back to Dortmund to pinch whoever. Royce, Aubameyang,
do you think
Hummels,
he'd do that? Do you
Gundogan.
Think he'd go back and have...
I don't think he'd have a problem. I just...
Oh, you don't think he'd have a problem going back to Dortmund? And
I don't think he should as well. Football's,
I think he will. I think
football's
he will, Chris.
A business.
Yeah, but I think he is so...
No. He's got a real chance. I mean, he could win the league for Liverpool this season. Potentially. They're not that far off the pace.
How many? What is it? 6 points or something?
Yeah, and top four, absolutely. That's a realistic aim for Liverpool. And
I think he'll leave Dortmund alone. I think he won't touch them. Well, any of their players.
But if he does, that has to be because he doesn't think he could get those players or they couldn't improve his team.
Oh, not because of some...
To me, I don't think it should be for nostalgic reasons.
Okay, some other scores from the weekend. Hoffenheim were 3-1 up against Andre Schubert's Gladbach, who are yet to lose in the Bundesliga under their new manager. But Gladbach pulled it back and got a 3-3 draw, denying Hoffenheim their second league win of the season. And former Fulham defender Sascha Rita, now at Schalke, scored a late own goal to draw 1-1 with Leverkusen on Sunday. Chris, how does this leave the Bundesliga table looking?
Bayern top by 8 points, Dortmund a second. Then there's a 7-point gap between the next group of teams. Wolfsburg a third and Gladbach are now fourth. Remember, they were bottom after five games.
It's amazing.
Lucien Favre left, and now all of a sudden, they could get back in the Champions League. Amazing turnaround there.
Chris, I'm off to Schalke on Friday and Stuttgart on Sunday, so I'll report back from those games next week.
Make sure you have a beer and a sausage.
I will do.
This is Football in Europe, Serie A Roundup.
Okay, a quick look at matters in Italy now. Two huge games on Monday night after we record this. So it's second versus first in Naples, Napoli, Inter. Inter 2 points clear of Napoli. And third place Fiorentina take on Sassuolo, who are seventh. A couple of games on a Monday, not doesn't usually happen. But Chris, at the weekend, Juventus do appear to be getting back into the title race.
Yeah, they are. They're up to fifth and now into the European places, having been written off by pretty much everybody. Four straight wins for Max Allegri's team. It was billed as Paolo Dybala's return to Sicily. He didn't score, but Mario Mandzukic, Stefano Storaro and Simeone Zaza did. And interestingly, after Zaza said publicly in his interview, he said top three by January is what we want. And I don't think you'd write Juventus off anymore. They're still a way behind in points, but up into those European places.
Wasn't Dybala brilliant against Manchester City as well? I just love the way he just will hassle and harry, much like Tevez did, I suppose, in that shirt. Chris, trouble for the Rome clubs. What's happening at Lazio and Roma?
Yeah, absolutely. Both coaches under big pressure as well. We'll start with Lazio, beaten by Empoli. They're down in 10th. Four defeats in their last five now. They qualified for the Champions League. Remember last season, finished third, then lost in the playoffs to Leverkusen, didn't make it to the group stage. Gazzetta dello Sport have written on Monday morning that Marcello Lippi and Christian Brocchi could take dual charge if they decide to get rid of Pioli, who did such a brilliant job last season. But things not going according to plan for Lazio right now. And the same with Roma after that absolute hammering. I know Barca were amazing, but Roma were pretty poor.
6-1 at the Nou Camp.
And I think that was the heaviest ever win for a Spanish team against an Italian side in European football, too. Like, you know, proud big nations in terms of club football. They were beaten at home to Atalanta. It's a bad week for Roma. And Rudy Garcia, pressure on him.
So they're talking
pressure about
him maybe losing his job, are they? I mean,
maybe, because when they're good, they're very good. And I think everyone mentioned Juventus back in this title race. But, you know, we've discussed the title's there for somebody like Roma this season, because Juve aren't as good as they have been. And they just don't appear to be able to strike clear, and it's 2-0 at home to Atlanta.
I think it'd be harsh to lose him, though, based on, you know, a couple of poor results. I do think he's an excellent coach and he's signed brilliant players.
Yeah, he is, and he's definitely improved him. I just think that the nature of that defeat, remember they got hammered by Bayern 7-1 last season, so it's not the... And if they want to be in the top echelon, you can't lose... You can't lose by that many goals.
So do you think they'll consider sacking him?
I think they'd consider it.
An ambitious club,
They're a very ambitious club. I don't think yet, but if they lose to an Atalanta at home again or that type of team, then maybe it might be his time up. But not yet, I wouldn't imagine. There's a terrible red card for Maicon in that game. Just an awful challenge for the penalty that made it 2-0.
Do we need a taxi for Maicon? Maybe we do.
Yeah, maybe we do.
Niang scored a couple of goals at AC Milan in a 4-1 win over Sampdoria. I think I'd already hadn't scored in 35 Serie A games or something, but he looked really good to me when he was out on loan in France. Sinisa Mihailovic getting one over on his former club, Sampdoria, who he was manager of and a player for.
There was some terrible defending in that game as well.
Just the worst. I think for one of the Niang goals, they basically gave him the ball on the edge of the box to score. But he got an assist as well and was very good. Meanwhile, Vincenzo Montella, the Sampdoria head coach, said, "I want an explanation. I didn't see any strength of character from his players." So strong words from the new Sampdoria manager. Chris, a quick one on Carpi.
Yeah, that tiny club in Serie A.
Tiny Carpi.
Makes him sound very nice, doesn't it? But they won first away win of the season at Genoa. So I think there's still 5 points from safety, but just about clinging on. And a stat from Archie Rintut here. Genoa had a player sent off for the 7th time this season.
So, hold on. How many games have we had? Like 15 or 16 or something in Italy?
Yeah.
7 red cards.
I mean, that is unbelievable.
God. Keep it together. And we got a really good top six now in Italy, haven't we, in the table?
Well, we have. Talk about all of the big boys are lining up at the top of the table. There's no shocks like there are in France or anywhere else. It's Inter top, 2 points clear of Napoli ahead of their game. Fiorentina are third behind Napoli on goal difference. Then Roma fourth, Juventus fifth, AC Milan sixth.
Not bad. OK, Chris, before we go, the Netherlands, what's happening there?
Well, as you were at the top of the table, because the top three won, Ajax 2-0 at Zwolle, Feyenoord 4-2 in the Rotterdam derby against Excelsior, and PSV beats AZ 3-0. It's a great title race, actually, isn't it? And I can't think, I might be incorrect, but a couple of years when the three big teams are all winning consistently, it's going to be really good in Holland, and a great day for De Graaf Schaap as well.
Yeah, because they won for the first time in the Eredivisie this weekend at the 13th time of asking. Promoted last season, and they beat Canberra, who still haven't won. 7 draws for them, though. That's a bizarre record, isn't
it? Seven draws.
You spotted something in Greece as well.
Yeah, goalkeeper scored. It's always great.
Oh, I love goalkeepers scoring.
Not just goalkeepers scoring, just when they run up the pitch.
They're clueless.
Yeah, but it causes absolute panic. It's like when you bring on Andy Carroll. You know, you can have a really good defensive unit and it's just a ball goes into the box. No one knows what's going on. It was in the Greek second tier, 95th minute.
Why wasn't I watching that?
I don't know. I don't think it was on BT. the leaders, Larissa, and this guy's name. Maybe this is why it isn't. I mean, this is for a commentator.
I cannot, because I've seen this written down. I cannot wait for you to try and pronounce this.
Gennadios.
Almost certainly wrong to start.
Gennadoshov.
Okay.
I've made him sound Russian, to be honest.
Okay, we'll speak to a Greek person and see how bad that was.
But when there's an X, unless it's Xavi, it's always a tough one to pronounce. But he scored, and they drew. And Olympiakos, of course, Arsenal go there next week in that massive game. They made it 11 wins out of 11, Gunners fans there.
Well, do you reckon Arsenal can get the... They need to win by 2 goals or by... I think 3-2 actually is enough, isn't it?
Yeah. My gut feeling is no. I think they'll come close. I think they might win, but I can see...
They'll do that Arsenal thing.
They'll do that, and Giroud will miss a header or something, 5 minutes in time, and that will be that. But, they've pretty much wrapped up the title, Olympiakos. And Gus Poyet's Ike Athens up to second ahead of Panathinaikos.
Gus Pochet, as we've discussed on a previous
Pochet.
Show. And I commentated on Zenit getting beaten 4-1 at Terek Groshny. This after Zenit made it 5 wins out of 5 in the Champions League. Truly bizarre performance. So we'll wrap up the first half of the season next Monday in Russia because they're going on their winter break. Don't forget to leave us a review on iTunes. That's a big help in keeping us in the charts. You can also follow us on Twitter at FIE Podcast. Let us know what you think of Florentino Perez and his spell as Real Madrid president and whether Guardiola should announce his plans for next season. And you can follow our Audio Boom account for exclusive content.
This is Football in Europe.